Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. This is your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our explorations of the cultures of consciousness. A couple of weeks ago, I guess over a month, I had the opportunity to go to Bioneers, which is a wonderful, really interesting conference, gathering, activist festival held in Marin County every October, and featuring a wide range of environmental activists, social activists, but really with a focus on the earth. And it's a very interesting slice of the richness of in contemporary environmental activism. And there's a very interesting sort of religious, spiritual underpinning and sometimes explicit expression at the event, which I've been attending off and on since the mid-90s, and that's really going to be our topic of conversation today. We're talking with Professor Bron Taylor, who wrote a wonderful book called Dark Green Religion that looks at nature, spirituality, in the context of environmentalism, and on a global level as well as a local one. And this Bioneers was interesting because I got to see a wonderful documentary, Who Bombed Judy Berry, by Daryl Cherney. And as probably some of you know, Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney were both very powerful environmental activists associated with the more radical sides of the movement, the kind of Earth First world that was quite prominent in the 1990s, especially with a variety of actions attempting to stop logging using direct action, and associated with other even more extreme reactions from some people in the radical environmentalist world, with which Dr. Taylor talks about. But one of the it was an amazing documentary. It was very well done because they had no talking heads from the present. All they showed was footage that was taken at the time, both from news shows and from videos that other activists had showing the events. So you'd actually see the confrontations with the loggers and all these different characters and the way they dressed and the songs and the way it was packaged in the news. And then the narrative was afforded by Judy Berry, who was talking about this mysterious bombing that occurred when she was at the height of her activist career in Oakland. And she later had cancer, and on her deathbed she gave a deposition for a suit that was ultimately ruled in the favor of the activists against the Oakland Police Department and other nefarious agencies, who did just a horrible, horrible, reprehensibly, clearly politically motivated job of trying to bury and obfuscate this crime. And so you get her story, telling her whole story through these images. And what was remarkable about it, and Professor Taylor talks about it in his book in one of my favorite chapters, because it really illuminated a lot for me, was simultaneously how these activists brought together very strong ideas about the future of the environment that were deeply embedded in scientific anticipations of how things are going bad, and we have also further evidence for this today, combined with this radical kind of countercultural militancy that looked and felt, more like the Black Panthers or almost a kind of anarchist Marxist party from the 60s or something. But at the same time, there's this profound spirituality. In fact, Daryl Cherney, the first time I saw him was at a pagan gathering in the 1980s or early 90s in Northern California, singing songs that were both about the earth and about animals and about this, spirit of Mother Earth. And so this mixture of science, of political radicalism and activism, and this kind of nebulous spirituality that doesn't quite look like religion as we normally think about it, was really striking to me. And then I subsequently read Professor Taylor's book, and it really helped illuminate a lot of these issues. And so I'm really happy that he joined us here on Expanding Mind. But before we bring him on, I'll bring on, of course, our co-host here, Maja Daou. Hey, Maja, how are you doing?
Hi, Eric. I'm good. Thanks.
Was there a specific, like, tree that you ever had? Because I know you grew up in a foresty land.
was
there a particular spot that you had that was, like, the magic spot that you'd go to when you were a kid?
I totally did. There was a forest that I would hang out, you know, in all the time as a teenager that was right near my house. And it was this triangulation of old pine trees. There was three of them, and they were huge, and they literally made this big triangle. And I mean, I hung out there probably almost every day of my high school existence. So, and it's funny, you know, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and in the early 90s, I was reading all of Dave Foreman, you know, his books from Earth First. I was reading Murray Bookchin. My uncle was like on this commune with Murray Bookchin, and I was deeply into all the Wendell Berry stuff, because on our debate team, like, the topic that year was environmentalism. So I read all that stuff, and then I went to the Evergreen State College in the Olympic National Forest, where the fight was happening as I was there. There was legislation in the Capitol with the loggers, and then all the hippies that were going to Evergreen were all having these huge protests. And so, I mean, I witnessed a ton of the Earth Firsters, you know, having these battles, because there were some of them that, you know, spiked trees and kind of were putting the loggers' lives in danger. So I really got to see a lot of that firsthand.
Yeah, it's a remarkable story, and I'm also kind of curious how it's changed today. And things really have changed in certain ways. I think in some ways for the better, and maybe in some ways for a little for the worse. But we'll talk about that with Dr. Taylor. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Well, it's my pleasure to join you.
Great, great. So I thought we'd start out just by letting you define dark green religion, which is kind of a phrase you've come up with as a way to differentiate what you're talking about to some degree from terms that maybe are more recognizable, like nature spirituality or earth religion. So you really want to do something, you're doing something really specific with this umbrella category. So I thought that might be a good place to start.
Sure. Well, I was looking for a trope for a wide range of social phenomena that didn't already have a lot of associations in the popular imagination. And I wanted to capture, first of all, kind of two things. One, the sense of a deep affective or emotional connection to the living world, the organisms that constitute it. So in that sense, the dark is a reference to what some would say is a deep ecological perception, and it involves a notion of intrinsic value, that all life has value apart from its usefulness to human beings. I also wanted to signal with the term dark, since that's often associated with something dangerous, that like all religion, dark green religion can have a shadow side. It can be perilous in one way or another. And certainly there are critics of these sorts of social phenomena and environmental resistance movements that you allude to, who say they are indeed both politically perilous and spiritually dangerous. But just in a nutshell, the main points that characterize dark green religion in a wide variety of different contexts around the world can be briefly summarized as nature is sacred. That's a common way that people speak in these subcultures. All living things have intrinsic value, as I've mentioned. All forms of life share a common ancestor and thus are kin, and thus we have moral responsibilities to all our relatives. Fourth, an ecology-based metaphysics of interconnection and mutual dependence. Deep feelings of belonging and connection to nature. And then finally, humility, an understanding that human beings are natural beings who, like all other organisms are subject to nature's laws. And although we might be exceptional in some ways, we're not exempt from nature's laws, including that of carrying capacity, wherein organisms that outstrip their food and water supplies or excrete more than more waste than their habitats can recycle will suffer declining birth rates and increasing death rates. So, in short, their numbers will decline, usually in ways that will involve significant suffering.
Yeah, the latter element is definitely on everybody's mind these days. It's amazing how how widespread, even in a somewhat unthought or unresearched way, a sense of threat seems to be even in the popular media. But I wanted to start with the idea of the sacred, because in some ways what one of the many things that interests me about your, not just your book, but the work in general, the space that you open up, is how it offers a unique way in which science and materialist naturalism based in Darwinism and a very rigorous view of how the world that we share actually works becomes interwoven, sort of drawn into kinds of experiences, ideas, language, affect that we associate with religion in a way that really nothing else does. And it's a really rich zone to think about what religion means today in a world that in many ways is so naturalistic and scientific. So I wanted to start with the idea of the sacred, because it's a very interesting term in how we understand religion, because on the one hand, and you talk about this, for some people it implies some belief in a supernatural deity and some ghosty invertebrate in the sky, if you're not in that zone, then you're not really talking about the sacred. But of course, for many, many people, they will willingly use the word and the emotions associated with the sacred to describe things that are otherwise perfectly natural. And the one thing that I'd like to bring in and have you reflect on is this wonderful idea that Eliade had, and that where he talks about, of course, the sacred and the profane is one of these fundamental divisions in human religious consciousness. And he makes this really interesting argument, which is that the sacred's always there, but it's always changing where it manifests. So it's like in any culture, you're going to have the sacred, but for these guys, it might be a stone. For these guys, it might be a ghosty invertebrate in the sky. For these people, it might be surfing, which is one of the things you talk about in the book. So there's a way in which the category of the sacred seems to be part of the way that modern people try to understand how to reconnect, but reconnect maybe in a way with new things, new objects, new ways of experiencing the sacred that take it out of the kind of traditional frame. So to put it in a nutshell, how has your studies of environmentalism reshaped what you feel, how you think about how people use the word sacred in a rich way?
Well, that's quite a lead-in. Where to begin? Let me just start by reflecting a moment on the general approach to the so-called religion phenomena, and then talk a little bit about the sacred.
Great.
If we look at some of the earliest roots of the word religion, it comes from the Latin religio, and the notion is that which has to do with being bound to or tethered to something of ultimate significance and value. So when I think about and what I've discovered around the world looking at diverse environment-related subcultures that are focused on the environment in some way, they typically have these deep feelings of belonging and connection to nature. So that kind of triggers a religion-related analysis, at least if you just look at the roots of the word. But it's very difficult, as you know, to define the word religion. There's lots of definitions of it. Perhaps the most traditional one that's rooted in a kind of a Western framework is the belief in non-material divine beings or spirits. But that doesn't work very well with a whole lot of things that we typically call religion, including certain Native American traditions, Buddhist traditions of various sorts, and so forth. So that's not really something that's essential to the term religion. So what I do in the book is I take what a number of scholars are doing today, and that's what we call the family resemblance school. We're not worrying too much about where the boundary of religion is, where what religion is and where that which is not religion begins. Rather, what we try to do is to look at the traits and characteristics that are typically associated with the phenomena, and then just go about analyzing human cultures and their the way in which people are involved in these, at least religion-resembling dimensions. The reason that that background is helpful is that when we look at these environment-related cultures, as you alluded to, some folks in them have what we might call conventionally religious beliefs in non-material divine beings of some sort. And others don't have such beliefs or perceptions at all. They're entirely naturalistic. And in the book, I talk about different groups and different individuals who are more conventionally religious or entirely naturalistic, but nonetheless come to share those basic ideas of dark green religion that I referred to. Now, where does that take us with regard to the notion of the sacred? Well, I think that we can understand the sacred as shorthand, as having to do with what people consider ultimately meaningful and valuable. And also, it has to do with places wherein people have transformative experiences or experience the transcendent or experience physical or spiritual healing in some way. So that's kind of what I mean by sacred. It has to do with ultimate meaning and value and transformative, if not transcendent, and healing power.
It becomes really important, that distinction of where does sacred start and where does it end, because I know, like, a big contention with some of these, you know, nature worship issues is like, well, okay, do we see, is nature this sacred place that exists outside of everything else? And then, you know, you get this thing that, like, Dave Foreman talked about, where now nature is separate from ourselves. There's this idea of the sacred, and then there's us, and then there's that place that is sacred, and we can only go there if we want to do the sacred things, you know, and then when we're done, now we're back in us, and we're not sacred. So it has this weird thing that happens when you allot a section or a place for that kind of, you know, ascribation, and then it kind of separates it from yourself and all the other stuff, you know?
Well, let me see if I can speak to that with a little story. I like telling stories. When I first went to study the radical environmental movement, I showed up with a group of 30 others in a clear-cut, a logging clear-cut section in the Shawamigan National Forest in northern Wisconsin. Now, the reason that that was the gathering place for these 30 activists was that it had already been hammered by industrial logging. So the feeling was that they could be near some old growth, some fragments of old growth forest, what little old growth ancient forest is left in Wisconsin, without camping there. Now, why was that? Well, they didn't want to camp in the most precious, most biologically diverse, most fragile part of the remnant forest for fear of desecrating it, for fear of damaging rare orchids that exist there and nowhere else. So a place that had already been hammered, that had already been, in their view, desecrated, but was still pretty nice. It was kind of like a clear-cut meadow, and there were trees around, and it was a good place to camp. That was a place that they could camp in good conscience without destroying some of the remnants that they considered especially sacred. So there was a kind of a demarcation there, a construction in their mind between the Holy of Holies, this ancient old-growth fragment, and a place that still was valuable but had already been seriously damaged. Now, I asked one of these activists a few days later, when we got back to what we might call more, a more highly developed area, how he makes these discriminations between what's sacred and what's not sacred, because I was certainly aware that there was this kind of language that was commonly used to describe what people most cared about in that movement. And he pointed to a Walmart that happened to be there in the big parking lot, and he said, well, you know, it's all sacred, all of it, the entire biosphere. And we have to make priorities on what we're going to protect, and the places that are the most biologically intact are our highest priority places. And so in a sense, he was saying those are the most sacred, the most holy places. But then at the same time, he said, you know, if we give this Walmart building and this parking lot some time, and if like Thoreau, we have faith in the seeds will germinate as cracks emerge in that pavement, and the plants will come forth, and they will break the pavement more, and then the trees will follow. And if you give this a significant period of time, the earth will reclaim this land. So I think that Eliot is an interesting character, and he kind of had this idea that the sacred, as you suggested, erupts at different times and places around the world, and that people recognize this kind of sacrality. But the sacred is also something that human beings, in fact, construct in their minds and decide what's more sacred, why is one place sacred and another place not sacred? Or are there, in the case of these biodiversity lovers, are there places that are more sacred than others, a higher priority than others, even if the entire biosphere is sacred and all the genetic and species variety of the planet is sacred? So how you construct your ultimate values, and for the biodiversity-focused Earth First movement people, it's the genetic and species variety of the planet. So the places where such diversity is most resident and most threatened would be the highest priority places, and therefore, in a way, even if they might say it's all sacred, they are at least implicitly saying that these are the most sacred places.
That's a wonderful example, again, of this way in which science, something you can actually quantify and talk about with a perfectly, you know, someone who's totally a naturalist or, you know, rational person, you know, it's quantify, look, genetic diversity, diversity of species, this, look, we can put this on a graph, we can quantify it. And yet that kind of principle then is brought into something that is much broader, that has these different dimensions to it that involve the sacred. That's a wonderful example, and I also have to, you know, bring up another great example from your book, in a, you know, a different register of surfing. And one of the things that I love about your approach to religion and spirituality is one that I've often wrestled with, because I'm interested in a lot of these sort of para-religious phenomena and popular culture and things, is how you frame what can be seen simultaneously as religious and spiritual by some people and as just perfectly natural and, in fact, not religious by other people. And you do a wonderful job of showing how surfing culture can be seen in this life for a variety of reasons. But I think the part I was most moved by was at one point you were talking about a conversation or an email conversation you had with someone who considered themselves a hardcore scientist atheist guy, and who was at first like, all this stuff about spirituality and surfing, maybe there's some other people think that, but that's sort of far away from where he was.
Right.
And then you explain
right.
to him, but hey, look, you have this ritual. Every morning you say you go out and you're sitting there, you have this relationship with the wild, with the sunrise, with the creatures in the water. You push your body into this flow state. You have these moments of epiphany. And then he's like, oh yeah, I totally see what you mean. And for me, that was really like a key moment in not just the topic about whether or not surfing is spiritual, how does it relate to a larger environmental spirituality, but also how we talk about and identify religious and spiritual phenomena and experiences in our modern, crazy, you know, multiple world.
Well, it was a really fun example to relate, wasn't it? I mean, I think that There's a lot of people who would say that they're not religious or even spiritual, and there's some who will say they're spiritual and not religious. And if people don't want to apply the R word to themselves or the S word to themselves, that's certainly fine with me. But I think that this is a good example where if you have the time and the luxury, if you will, to talk with someone at some depth and to point out that their daily practice resembles religious ritual, for example, and the transformative power of those experiences resembles what conventionally religious people get from their religions, and how it informs also their moral values and their ethical practices, then even if they still don't want to call themselves religious or spiritual, they can see that there are important affinities between their own worldviews and their own daily practices and their own values and that which is typically called religion.
Well, and it seems just to take a little farther is why that's important. It's not just about, you know, how do we talk about religion? You and I are interested in the study of religion, and so this is an important point for us. Other people might not be so interested in it, so it's on the surface not so interesting. But it does relate on something much more profound about your argument in the book, which is you're really trying to say, hey, how do we think about a global environmental religious ethic that really looks and smells like religion and is explicitly embraced as such by many people, but is also of the character that people who are not interested particularly in religious language and dialogue can resonate with and recognize so that you have a possibility of a deeper kind of broad-based social movement? I mean, isn't that part of what you're pointing
for? And I'm delighted that you got that. because indeed, you know, there's far too much division around the world that's religion-related and between people who are religionists and those who are not. And part of what I've been privileged to do is to travel widely around the world and to be engaged with people who are involved in environmental and social justice causes in lots of different contexts. And what I'm doing in the book, I think, is and what I think I've done through these experiences, I've just noticed quite common patterns around the world, despite great diversity among different ethnic and national and religious groups. And these kind of core beliefs that I've identified as dark green religion that can be widely shared and indeed are shared by people who are not religious in their own minds and would disavow belief in any kind of invisible divine being, and those who are more conventionally religious. And while it's often difficult for people who are devotees of the world's predominant religions to graft on these dark green religious sentiments onto their traditions, in fact, that's occurring. And that's, in fact, something that we can expect if, as Emile Durkheim suggested, the great sociologist, religion is a reflection of the culture and the cultures in which it is situated, then as these cultures become greener and as they integrate scientific understandings such as of evolution and of ecological interdependence and mutual dependence, then these scientific notions will become integrated and fused, at least for some, within those religious cultures with their existing religions. So
do you feel like the mechanism that's causing that shift? I mean, is it cultural? Is it experiential? Do you feel like that happens because it's just like enough people do it, or what do you think is making that happen at the bottom of it?
Well, that's a great question, but I think there are many paths here.
Yeah.
On the one hand, some people. Let me just preface this by saying that the kinds of feelings and perceptions that people have who are involved knowingly or unknowingly in what I'm musingly calling dark green religion, they have these because this is a part of the human emotional repertoire, this ability to feel joy and ecstasy at existence, the capacity to feel like you belong to wider systems of life and that you share kinship feelings with them. All these kinds of notions, these are not exclusive to one sort of human being. In fact, these are these sorts of emotions, these sorts of perceptions are available to all of us because it comes with our long evolutionary process as part of our genome. Now, some people are privileged to grow up in more biologically intact natural places, and they develop a deep feeling of connection for them by virtue of having that privilege. Some people have their primary caregivers who spend a good deal of time kind of pointing them and alerting them to the mysteries and wonders of their natural surrounds, so they have good immediate teachers. Other people don't. Other people are brought up in different sorts of families that don't have those interests, or they're brought up in very urban settings and have very little contact with relatively natural environments. And yet, no small number of those people nonetheless manage to gravitate toward these sorts of affective and spiritual perceptions of nature and the corresponding values that tend to go with them. One of the ways in which this occurs is through the arts, and I spend a good deal of time in the book talking about the way that diverse arts, from poetry to nature writing to documentaries to animated film, theatrical film, and we could go these days even video games, we can go on and on, theme parks, we can go on and on in the diverse ways in which people both express and promote these sorts of nature spiritualities with no small measure of effect. And so part of what I'm saying in the book is that even though dark green religion has no official organization or name, that doesn't mean that it doesn't have both individual and institutional proponents. There are many expressions for that and many ways in which both individuals and groups try to, shall we say, evangelize their nature spirituality.
Yeah, and I think the institutional aspect is also a particularly interesting part of your argument, because once you see that side of things and then you look around you and you realize the number of institutions that have that as part of their kind of ideological DNA, that it becomes a much different question than just, you know, individuals going off backpacking and having experiences or creating, you know, bioregional subcultures or whatever. It takes on a different picture. But we're going to have to take a break right now, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with Bron Taylor about dark green religion, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou. We're here with Eric Davis talking to Bron Taylor about dark green religion. I didn't think that would be a really good band name or t-shirt or something like that, you know. But I was wondering, Bron, if you would like to share, I'll give you another opportunity to tell stories because I like hearing stories too. Have you had I'm sure you've had many, but can you tell us or share with us a significant, deep experience you had in the dark greenness of the world that kind of showed you what this is all about? Did you have a direct experience that was extremely profound for you?
Well, sure. I grew up in Southern California. And I like a lot of youngsters growing up in Southern California, I mean, there's a certain age where you actually played outdoors. And there were hills around where I was living in South Pasadena, the Monterey Hills. And that's where we played. We played in these places. And one day, a large number of bulldozers showed up and started to clear these hills for a very, very large development project. And I remember being kind of outraged at this. I mean, who the heck were these people? I didn't know anything about private property rights, and I didn't have these notions of progress in my mind that this was all a good thing, right? I was just enchanted with these places and was outraged that they were being razed. And I went home and I talked to my rather conventional parents about it, expressing those feelings, and you know, the response was what you might expect there in the 60s. Well, that's progress. And I think that is a signal of how deeply entrenched that sort of presupposition was. And I didn't think about it for a long time. But when I began to notice people in the Earth First movement blockading roads going into ancient forests, or trying to sabotage the Barstow to Las Vegas desert race. I mean, I was already at that time very interested in, I'd become interested in religion and rebellion as a scholar. But I know that when I first began to get those reports, I was kind of moved by that. And I thought, I need to find out what these people are about. And as soon as I did, I also, as a fledgling religion scholar at the time, I quickly realized that there was something deeply religious about this, or spiritual, if you will, at least, and that was part of the motivation for these folks. And it just seemed to me that this was a group that I wanted to learn more about. And so I left, as soon as I could, I left for the woods to find these folks and to basically try to work out my own environmental ethics in the midst of that social movement. Because even though I was studying for a PhD in ethics, nobody was talking about environmental ethics at that time, at least within, at least at the University of Southern California. And in fact, I think there was only one professor in the country teaching an environmental ethics course at the time. So that's just one example. There are others, but you know, it is interesting to ask the question, why does this sort of thing strike a chord with some people and not others? It's quite common within the so-called radical environmental movement for people to have had an experience like mine. Of, in fact, one attorney for many of the environmentalists who have been arrested over the years told me accurately about a year ago when I was interviewing her that's the sort of experience that she called the gateway drug of radical environmentalism.
But it's true. Some people get it, and other people, they could care less. Like, I mean, I grew up in a forest, and I remember as a kid, my mom we saw the Emerald Forest movie. I don't know if you remember that one. It's good,
sure.
You know, and I was like crying. I was like ruined by it. I was decimated. And then like my sisters were just kind of like, meh. You know, it didn't reach them in the same places. So it is, I think part of it is experiential, but I kind of feel like some people are just more kind of nature-y, fairy type of people. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it, but
well, in a way,
really...
that points to this point we made just before the break, which is that, you know, and whether you think about just ordinary people who are living their citified lives, or even about intellectuals who are thinking about the future of the globe and have, you know, for a variety of reasons, problems with religious language, or whether they're, you know, Dawkins-style atheists or postmoderns who are suspicious about any kind of
substantial ideology or anything like that. These actors are very, very much a part of our modern world. They're everywhere. They're not going away. They're going to change and come up with their own novel ways of engaging the future alongside of these more explicit environmentalist or nature spiritual ways. So it's really about a kind of almost a trick of how those profound affect, those experiences, those intense emotional feelings and motivating transformations that can happen to so many people can somehow find a way to talk to people who don't have them. Because you can't, it's dangerous to get in a situation of going, oh, those people don't get it, they're mundanes, they're cut off, they're soulless, they're broken, they don't hear the cries of the bears or whatever it is. And it's a very, very difficult problem, because when you're inside of those experiences, they're so powerful, they're so motivating, even if you might argue about how to manifest them in action, there's no question that that's part of what's motivating you. And sometimes, in environmentalism, I get this sense sometimes that there's this idea that we all have the potential for that experience. And that what we need to do is to create opportunities for everybody to have those kinds of experiences. And once that happens, then there will be a groundswell of affect that can motivate a truly global environmental ethics. And I'm skeptical about that. I'm not sure that human beings at this point in history are more diverse than that. And I wonder about how to integrate this powerful emotional, affective, transformative experiences, whether they're considered religious or not, with the fact that many people just don't really do that.
Yeah. Well, you've identified a whole bunch of the conundrums that I think thoughtful people in these movements are often wrestling with. I mean, one of the epistemological premises that are common in these movements is that the fundamental problem is our disconnection from nature. You know, we don't have these deep feelings of belonging and connection, many of us. And one of the epistemological premises or sort of theories of how you get this kind of experience is that you need direct visceral experience to relatively intact biological systems. Now, if that's true, then as human beings become increasingly urbanized and technologized, if by that we mean increasingly consumed with technological society and gadgets, then we can surmise that there's going to be a decreasing number proportion of human societies who have these kinds of deep feelings of belonging and connection to nature and want to stand up and defend them. Now, some people in the movements, I think, don't necessarily buy that, and they suggest that while it's difficult to get people to click into their natural affective connection to nature if they have very little contact with it, that indeed we can, in a variety of ways, effectively break through that, at least for some people. So you mentioned Emerald Forest, I think it was, and how that was moving for you. The movie Avatar, I would say, is a more recent example, which got even more global exposure.
Right.
That is trying to evoke in people their natural. I think there is a kind of subtle assumption there that kind of film can evoke in people a natural affinity for the green world. Now, whether that's true or not, we can debate, but I can say that, in fact, I have a book on Avatar coming out in 2013, a book of essays about it, and some of those essays look at the response of people, many of whom are not or were not nature lovers, but were moved by the film and wondered why they had no exposure to a place as beautiful as that, which, of course, they recognized was a metaphor for earthly systems before they go down before industrial development. So some activists and activist intellectuals, on the other hand, sometimes wonder if there's just a kind of a gene that some people have almost, that whereby they have this natural affinity and others don't. But I think there's some interesting theories emerging from environmental and evolutionary psychologists, including E.O. Wilson and Stephen Kellert and others, who have articulated this biophilia hypothesis. And in a nutshell, what they argue is that people do have at least a weak aesthetic appreciation for relatively intact biological systems, because we know deep down in our genome that these are places where we flourish, where we can have ecstatic experiences. And why then, they would be asked, do we have so much ecological destruction if there is such a biophilia in humans? And they would say, well, it is a weak biological trait that can be, and here I'm paraphrasing or speculating a little bit, but it can be encrusted by all the things that human beings are capable of distracting themselves with. But if there's something to that theory, then there's something to work with among human beings, whatever their station in life, to try to reach them and touch them with what they, if they don't know, they ought to know and are capable of knowing about the value and beauty of the biosphere and all that dwells within.
Yeah, I can really see that the it's almost like a, I mean, it's a very powerful working hypothesis for organizing culture and activism and how messages are spread. But I'm thinking of another question that's somewhat related, perhaps, is that when I saw your title, Dark Green Religion, and you mentioned that one of the reasons you use the word dark is to indicate a shadow side, and you talk about some of these questions in your book, you know, the problems of that some people see of a potential kind of global fascism, and the problems of not paying attention to the social needs of particularly urban poor, who don't really have the opportunity to have these kinds of transformative experiences, but are really at the leading edge of sufferers of capitalism, at least in the modern world, and so how environmentalism and capitalism critiques go together. But I had a kind of a different thought about this phrase that actually picks up with what Maja said, where it sounds like a great band title. And what made me think of black metal, of this sort of, incredibly, it's like this sort of post-satanic, anti-humanist, harsh music, and a very strong subculture that's been around for, 20 years now, all over the world. And there's a strong vein of black metal that is profoundly, melancholically environmentalist. But it's in this mode, this kind of anti-humanist mode, this kind of sense that humans are hopeless, a rotten species, just bereft, and that where value lies is in nature, and that because things just sort of seem kind of apocalyptic, there's not much else to do other than mourn. And I'm not saying that that's a particularly good position for an activist to take, but what it made me think about and question, and it kind of runs through your book too as a thread, is the aspect of green spirituality, of nature spirituality, that's sort of like, actually, human beings, for all their biophilia, aren't really part of the story at this point. You know, that they're the profane. They're the thing that is, kind of causing the problem. And you get this Manichaeism, which we know from the history of religions is a very attractive religious mode. There's good and evil. There's the saved, the remnant, and the fallen. But then you have it weirdly applied to, like, humanity in general. And I know this isn't a dominant strain of nature spirituality, but it is a powerful one in some ways, and certainly in some radical environmentalism. So I'm curious how you've come to think about that strain of dark green religion.
The misanthropic, you mean?
Yeah, misanthropic. Great way of putting it.
Yeah. Well, there is kind of be a little Manichaean. Let's say for the sake of the argument that there's two extremes here, and there's, of course, a continuum between them. Another quick story. I'm early in my field work within the radical environmental subcultures. A young forest activist who has studied a little bit of religion at a university finds out I'm a religious studies scholar and assumes that I must think just like his professor, and says, and asks me if I know Eliade. And I said, well, yeah, sure, I know Eliade. And he says, well, you know, we just have to overcome them with woo. Now, and he had a button on that said, no, us, them. You know, one of those symbolic buttons?
Yeah.
His spirituality was to break down the dualisms between us and even our adversaries, and to have this kind of spiritual perspective that we need, that's the path forward, to sort of stress oneness and help and change consciousness so that people recognize that. Okay? So that's kind of one side. The other side is more misanthropic, that views human beings as kind of like the only cancerous species on the planet, with a voracious appetite for all other life forms, and ultimately as a destructive force. And then you've got positions all the way between that. Now, despite that, those are pretty stark differences between those two kinds of perspectives, and yet they would still tend to agree with some of the basic premises of dark green religion: the intrinsic value of all life, the sacrality of nature, that we need to understand ecological systems, you know, that we need to develop a deep sense of humility about the human place in the scheme of things, and so forth. How do you resolve that kind of binary between those differing perspectives? Well, I don't know, but I think it's quite clear that either perspective is a little bit too, on the one hand, one side is probably unduly optimistic about the human species, and the other side tends to conflate all human beings put them all into the same basket. Even if this black metal group, I think you're quite astute to note that the sort of black metal nature, people with nature affinity, how if you're completely pessimistic about the human species, you end up rather nihilistic, and you just mourn, and you don't get active. It's disempowering to have a completely negative view about the human species, and it doesn't tend to redound in environmental action.
Well, and some of it really reminds me of, like, these people that are the pro-lifers that will then shoot the abortion doctors, you know? And it does. It has this, if all life is sacred and everything, you know, has that capacity, then how can you justify murdering somebody or, like, you know, taking down these people that are involved? Because that was some of the, you know, or even in black metal, like, they'll murder people but then have this, like, idea of what the sacred is, and they'll justify these sure. destructive actions with the idea of the sacred and the idea of the holy. And I think that how that happens harkens back to what you were saying with the Eliade, which is if you separate it from yourself, you're not one, it's not a whole, it's the you and the other. So you can
sure.
you use that in order to perform those kinds of actions.
Well, you know, anybody who studies religion seriously is worried about the phenomena, in part for the reason you mentioned, and the other is that religion tends to divide people into categories as well, as kind of super people or holy people and ordinary folks and
yeah.
And subhuman people or subhuman persons. And the latter, of course, can be subjugated and repressed, and the holy people are to be venerated and revered. So in addition to the violence that we've seen again and again and again as people who demarcate some place or some people as especially sacred and others as not, when it comes to these sorts of movements, I think it's really important to be alert to those possibilities. That's one of the reasons that the book was titled that, and that I talk about it in the book. I've actually talked a lot more about that kind of dynamic in journal articles, such as in the Journal of Terrorism and Political Violence. And we've certainly seen some examples where at least some people in the global environmental movement have argued for and deployed avowedly violent tactics in their struggles and strategies. So this is a thorny mix that we're getting into here. A part of what I do at the end of the book is I talk about some of the ideas that are typically involved in an evolutionary and ecological worldview, and drawing also on a political theorist and friend of mine, Dan Dudney, we wrestle with what are the odds of these sorts of dark green spiritualities really moving in a dramatic way toward endorsing and precipitating violence. And there's some strong ideas in these movements that make that less likely than it would otherwise be, but not impossible. And we also have the fact that when it comes to social movements, perhaps especially radical ones, they tend to draw troubled people. And it only takes a few troubled people to take otherwise very positive movements move them, at least for a few individuals, in a very troubling direction.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up here, and I don't want to end on the bummer violence note. I just want to emphasize that again, you know, I really encourage people to read your book, and particularly the case you made, which you won't have time to talk about here, towards the end, about how important the global and even institutional framework is for this to go forward, and that the bioregionalism that we see now, that's so much a part of contemporary culture, that's very powerful, very creative, very romantic, very appealing, is really not sufficient, and that there's something on a larger global scale that you've been pointing towards, and that you articulate partly through the sort of civic religion idea. So I just wanted to bring that in there because it is a really powerful and very pragmatic vision as well. But we'll have to end it there. I want to send people to your website, brontaylor.com. Hey, Bron, thanks so much for being here. This was a great conversation.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a joy.
Wonderful. Okay, from Maja and me to all you guys out there, keep your minds open.